This podcast of The Business is a production of KCRW Santa Monica at 89.9 FM, webcast at kcrw.com, and distributed by NPR.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Borders, presenting books, music, and movie gift ideas from The Gift Squad. Details at bordersgifts.com.
From KCRW in Santa Monica, I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner, and this is The Business.
So you still want to do the show business, and you think that you got what it takes? I mean, you really got to rap and be all that, but prepare yourself for the breaks. Check it out.
This week on The Business, 'tis the season for gifting in Hollywood. Plus, the Irish say writers are failed talkers. Today, we'll let you be the judge. And finally, how the record companies learn to stop worrying and love the web. But first, it's the Hollywood News Caravan. Don't go anywhere. It's The Business from NPR. While it's unlikely that Hollywood execs will be seen at the Ivy sharing the grilled veggie salad with Michael Richards or Mel Gibson anytime soon, it would be way too early to count either one of them out of the picture just yet. Perhaps because of Michael Richards' recent racist diatribe at the Laugh Factory, the just-released Season 7 DVD of Seinfeld is selling gangbusters, almost making it to Amazon's top 10 DVD list. And Variety is reporting that Disney has high expectations for Mel Gibson's new film Apocalypto, opening the Mayan language epic on 2,500 screens, up from the originally planned 2,000. While this news might be good for actors who hate minorities, it's not so great for minority actors. A new UCLA study shows that casting directors take race and sex into account in ways that would be blatantly illegal were they used in any other industry, according to the study's author. UCLA law professor Russell Robinson told Variety, quote, "Many actors accept this as normal, but depending on the facts of the case, lawsuits can be filed." Right. Suing the studios and networks. That's sure to help a minority actor find more work. There won't be any retribution for that. What's needed, of course, is action at the state level. If only California had a governor who was from Hollywood, a governor who understands what it means to be a struggling actor who no one wants to take seriously because of your color or your sex or your accent. In other news, the Christmas shopping blitz is well underway, but once again, Hollywood's internecine fight over new DVD technology means there will be few, if any, high-definition DVDs hung in the stockings with care. Sony, Fox, and MGM are backing a high-definition DVD format called Blu-ray. Warner Brothers, Universal, and Paramount are all rooting for Toshiba's rival format, called HD-DVD. Happily, a new chip from a group of nerds at Broadcom will allow electronics manufacturers to make a single player to handle both types of DVDs. Then it appears our high-definition Christmas wishes will be finally answered. But by the time manufacturers get their bits in a row, packaged DVDs may have become passé as download mania marches on. Walmart formally announced the launch of its own video download service, which is a pretty big deal. Walmart accounts for an astonishing 40% of all DVD sales in the U.S. They're making a smart move. Technology is threatening to make middleman retailers like Walmart irrelevant. More evidence? Time Warner, the world's largest media company, made its own big download announcement last week. According to CNN Money, Time Warner plans to offer services that let consumers download movies from the internet that can be burned onto DVDs in 2007. But for all this talk of downloads, it's the digital upload that made the biggest news last week. Mark my words, the digital upload will be to the rest of the decade what the download has been thus far. For proof of this, see YouTube's announcement last week of a deal with Verizon. Per the BBC, the Verizon tie-up means that users will be able to upload short clips captured on their mobile phones. In other words, suddenly there are hundreds of millions of Cub reporters and cameramen out there, all ready to upload their own Zapruder video, or at least footage of Britney Spears buying panties. Finally, the end of the year is near, the time when Hollywood plays its least favorite but most addictive game. How much do you make, and why am I not making as much as you, you talentless witch? According to the Hollywood Reporter's list of the top earning actresses in Hollywood, Nicole Kidman is number one, making $16 million a picture. At number 10, Jennifer Aniston ekes out half that amount at $8 million. Julia Roberts didn't make the list, but only because she didn't work this year. Now, before any of these women get a swelled head, let's take a moment to acknowledge one thing. It's Celine Dion's world, and we're just living in it. The multi-platinum thrush came down with a chest cold last week and announced she's canceling 5 nights at Caesar's Palace in Las Vegas. Understand, Dion, with her three-year, $100 million contract, stands to lose well over $800,000, or $111 a minute. We know the heart will go on, but for her sake, let's hope the lungs do too. And that's the Hollywood News Caravan. Coming up next, Hollywood puts the extreme back into Xmas.
And you're here in my heart, and my heart will go on and on.
December is upon us, and with it, the season of gift-giving. Maybe there are gifting traditions in your family. Maybe you open presents on Christmas Eve or Christmas morning, give gifts only on one day of Hanukkah or all eight. Maybe there's a dollar limit. Or maybe you do some sort of nutty gift exchange. Hollywood has its own arcane set of gifting rules. And since they haven't changed in the past decade, let alone the last year, we thought we'd revisit our gifting conversation from December 2005 with Variety's Dana Harris. Dana Harris, welcome to the business.
Thank you.
Tell us a little bit, first of all, what is the standard protocol? Is there one for what you have to give and who you have to gift?
Gifts are a very complicated cultural issue in Hollywood. At the very lowest level, you are obliged to give a greeting card to anybody you may or may not have met who may be of some use to you in the year ahead. And that's a pretty awesome list of people. The idea is basically a stamp is cheap, cards are cheap. Wouldn't you rather not take the chance of offending somebody? The next level is when you have a client or a producer or even a sound mixer who you value, and you're obliged to give them a gift of some ilk, and then it goes up from there up to the very top, the toppermost, the Tom Cruises, the Tom Hanks, the Reese Witherspoons. That there's a concern that if you don't give them the right gift, that you somehow are going to cause irreparable damage to your relationship. It's a very fraught time.
So what is the caste system? That is, if I am, say, a star on a WB show, what might I get? Is there a sort of high-end and low-end minimums? Are there goalposts to aim for so that we do not offend the delicate sensibilities?
There's always a goalpost to aim for, but it changes from year to year. Last year's goalpost was the iPod. Well, the only problem was that if you were B, C-level star, you could very easily wind up with a half a dozen iPods.
Do you know of instances where there's
I do know of instances when people have wind up with half a dozen iPods and are giving them to their assistants, they're giving them to their assistants, and it really makes the whole process, seem like a farce, which it is anyway.
On one level, it must be comforting, because if you just became, say, a working actor on a show, then you go, I've arrived, I've gotten to the iPod level.
Yes, absolutely. And there is a confirmation of that. That's a point where people say, okay, now I know I must be of some value to you. And really, that's the main problem in terms of the whole gifting ritual, is that it's not so much that you want to give someone a gift because you care about them. It's that you know that even at the highest levels, there is a paranoia that's built in, that what happens if they don't care about me anymore? What if they don't worry about me? What if I'm no longer that person? Because they need to know that you're thinking about them. They need to know that they have not been forgotten, that if you are one of the 20 female stars at CAA, and I'm actually being kind there, I'm sure they have many more than 20, that you have been thought of, because, oh my God, otherwise they could have given gifts to the other 19. And if they gave those gifts to them, they're probably giving them scripts to them. And if they're giving them scripts, I'm not getting those scripts, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
The downward spiral.
The downward spiral.
So is there a difference between, say, what I would give an executive versus what I would give a producer versus another agent or another manager or,
There's all sorts of levels for this. I mean, and I would not pretend to be a professional in this, mm-hmm. nor would I want to be. There are people who are very highly paid in this area and have made entire businesses out of how to gift people. There's a place called The Art of the Gift that specializes in trying to find gifts that aren't going to be re-gifted, that are going to wind up being kept by people, that will make people feel special.
But it's comedic on the face of it.
It's ridiculous.
Because as far as I know, Jerry Bruckheimer actually owns a town in Kentucky.
Correct.
Doesn't he?
Need has nothing to do with this. This is all about, this is like a pledge. This is like a showing that you care about what, about this person. It has nothing to do with actually needing the stuff.
Now, The thing I have to ask about, just as a reporter, the logo issue. You know, regularly you would get, come Christmas time, not only cards from people you'd never met or barely remembered,
but you would
receive a beautiful bauble from Tiffany's, generally. And it was a beautiful box, or it was a beautiful piece of crystal, which had on it, you know, from your friends at Schmegma Co. Film
right,
processing.
Right.
You know, and I think to myself, not only do I have no friends there, I don't even remember setting foot in this company. Is there... to logo or not to logo?
Is that something people wrestle with anymore?
Yeah,
oh, absolutely. Logoing is a verb. Logoing is a real verb, and that is something that people I've talked to in the business who, again, make a business out of figuring out how to give gifts in Hollywood as to how to logo. If you should logo, should one logo in this manner or that manner? Is there a way to do it subtly? Those are real significant issues that people have, because they want people... Again, they want logos on their gifts for the same reason they want their name on the credits. I want proof that I did this. You know, they have to have that. They want their pound of flesh too. If they're going to be giving you a beautiful baccarat paperweight, you are going to damn well know where that paperweight came from.
There's a certain remove that people are doing all this important gift giving. In all likelihood, they never saw the gift they sent.
In almost all likelihood, it truly is at a remove. I mean, which is one of the things that I personally find so creepy about the whole process. You know, because as a reporter, you know, you are most of the gifts that you get, which is, you know, just fine, thanks, we don't want anything, are greeting cards. And one of the reasons I hate these greeting cards is because they are so completely impersonal. They are either printed out en masse, or at the very least, or whatever, the most they would do is a signature that is like one big swoosh that could have been done by anybody.
Did you receive the anonymous paperweight that my second assistant sent you?
Correct. Even though, you know, as reporters get gifts at a much, 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 much lower level than, say, you know, a producer does, the logic's the same. It's still a very impersonal process. There's no way in the world that, you know, Bob Iger is going out, you know, Christmas shopping. He hires people to do Christmas shopping. They hire people to do the Christmas shopping. I mean, it's like, it's not, there's, and that's why it's such a weird and complicated and technical process. It's because it is done at a remove, and it somehow has to get communicated from hand to hand. And when it comes back to, it's like, why do I have a pound of smoked trout? What am I supposed to be doing with this? So there has to be some kind of communication that goes on to make the gift make sense when it finally does get to the person who's opening it.
So what's curious, though, is that nobody has time in this business. Everyone is pressed for time, harassed for time. You go to drinks with someone, they're checking their voicemail, they're checking their BlackBerry. They can't let one know, yes, it has to, you know, be fired off with their crackberry in their hand. Why not write someone a note? Why not say something like, you know, I'm taking 15 minutes out of the day to sort of emphasize to you, you know, what our relationship means? Wouldn't that be more valuable?
You would think that, but I don't think that is the case at all. In fact, I kind of see what the result of that would be a, you know, screw you. You know, who are you to do this to me? You're so cheap that you can't, you know, put yourself out for me.
How dare you humanize this business?
Exactly. But also you have to remember the level of paranoia here is that if someone gives a gift of a letter, for instance, the thought is not going to be, my God, how kind, how heartwarming. The thought is going to be, that son of a bitch. He doesn't want to take the time to go get the guy from Barney's to do this. And he thinks he's going to pawn me off on this cheap piece of stationery. That's going to be the thought.
It's very nice stationery. But, you know, you're right. And I think that probably would be the reaction. And I think part of the reason might be also because people are so pressed for time, what they want is not your time. They want their time, right?
Correct.
They want 2 hours at Burke Williams, you know, to be rubbed and pampered, or someone to.
Of course, the absurdity is that we in this business, there people who are able to go to spas and what have you, they have all that stuff to the nth degree. The real kind of time that they want to have is truly only a gift they're going to be able to give themselves. There's no one in the world who can give that to them.
Dana Harris, thanks for being on The Business.
My pleasure.
In case you're thinking we're making too much of the whole Hollywood gifting thing, here are some of last year's holiday reflections from a group of agents, producers, and writers.
In a world where people are always asking the studio for something, will you meet this person, will you buy the script, will you make this movie, there's a two-week period where people are actually giving you something and supposedly not asking for anything in return.
$100 bottle of wine that a writer loves that wine, that would be a great gift to them. The same gift for an actor, I think, would be less good. They would rather have a motorcycle, even if they don't ride a motorcycle.
You definitely hear stories about people sending champagne to an alcoholic. I was given a tin of cookies by an actress who had found out that I was pissed at her, and there was only 6 of them in the tin, and I realized that she must have made like 30 cookies and sent them to 5 other people. So her good gesture made me really, really angry.
What is everyone else likely to give that person, and how can your gift be bigger, better, more impressive, flashier, more valuable, more thoughtful than everyone else's gift? This is competitive.
Certain people in certain offices, have just tons and tons of gifts, and some don't. And you can kind of tell where you are in the Hollywood pecking order to a certain extent by the kinds of gifts you get.
The apology gift. Very often, those are the best gifts of all. So in some ways, in the entertainment business, it's not bad to be wronged by someone.
I've gotten a bottle of champagne every year from the same guy. And in between getting this Christmas champagne, he calls me a every time we're on the phone.
If you pay for a writer's valet parking at dinner, they consider that a very nice gift.
I reject the idea that everyone has to give gifts. I don't think that not giving gifts has hurt me in any way. Personally, I do. I think it's a relief to some people.
It doesn't make a yes more likely. It makes a no forced to be timed differently. So you wait until January to say the no.
I tend to like to try and select gifts that are going to red flag my expense account, $1,200 trips to strip clubs.
If you heard that, Adam Sandler bought his agent a Cadillac, then suddenly Jim Carrey is now buying his agent a Porsche. We bought cars for people. We bought trips for people. We've outfitted certain houses with big screen TVs, satellite, music systems.
We're happy to send a bottle of wine or an iPod or whatever, but we're much happier to spend money that way than we are in paying people to do actual work.
When NBC or some other network goes out with an A-level gift and a B-level gift, and you find out some of your friends got an A gift and you only got the B-level gift, it makes you feel diminished.
And then there are times when you give, you give a really nice gift, and then you get a call later saying, I appreciate that really nice worldwide trip you bought me, but can I exchange it for a car?
I remember having a client who was given tickets to an event and the use of a private plane to fly to that event with some friends. And after that person went to the event, they called me and complained about what kind of private plane they were given.
I actually find with writers in general that expensive alcohol is usually a good choice that you can never go wrong with.
By accepting them, am I saying that thing that we talked about is actually going to happen? If you send me a script and then you send me a bottle of champagne, the second I open that champagne, do we have a deal?
People who are in recovery who can't get alcohol. Cheese.
Coming up after a short break, Hollywood's writers put words in their own mouths for a change. You're listening to The Business from NPR. This is The Business, and I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner. The value of the writer has always been at issue in Hollywood. Some insist that they're just a bunch of whiny, overpaid divas. Others consider them the very heart and soul of good movies and television. One thing is for sure. While their words are spoken, they usually go unheard. It's the mission of the Writers Guild to change that. And to that end, the WGA Foundation recently released a book of short essays by successful writers about the business of their craft. Called Doing It for Money, alluding to the slightly unsavory act of selling your words, the book also includes tips from experts and great chapter intros by its editor, Daryl G. Nickens. In a regularly irregular feature we'll call The Writer Speaks, we'll invite writers featured in the book to come down to talk to us and read their essay. Our first contestant is Wesley Strick, who has written, co-written, directed, or written and directed, 10 films, including Cape Fear, Doom, and Arachnophobia. According to his bio, he's written an equal number of uncredited movies, and those films have all been bigger hits than his credited films.
While I was still a civilian living in New York City, I read Adventures in the Screen Trade by William Goldman, and full of all of his, you know, ups and downs. So that was my sense of what it would be like to be a screenwriter. And in a sense, it's that's proved out, because there's a lot of ups and there's a lot of downs. Writing in Hollywood is, for me, joyous in the sense that you sit at home and you do what it is you do, which is you imagine and you put it on paper and you get paid for it. But then there's always comes the moment where you have to have the meeting, and you sit opposite these guys that are either your producers or your executives, but they are the boss. And they start to vivisect your screenplay. And it's painful. It's tough. You have to just, you know, go with it. Nod, take notes, promise that you'll try something different, go home and take a deep breath, take a hot bath, you know, whatever it is that keeps you going.
Here's Wesley Strick reading his essay, The Snit, which, by the way, is an anagram minus one letter.
The writer flies to London to hook up with the director, a big bluff lovable. Is there any other kind? Aussie. Together, the two catch a plane for Johannesburg, the writer's second 11-hour flight in 2 days. At Joburg, they board a prop plane no bigger than a station wagon with wings and fly into the bush, landing on a runway, read dirt road, adjacent to a resort called Bad Plas, read bad place. Why have they come all this way? To meet with the star, of course, who's completing work on a period film set in Africa and has installed himself in a magnificent tent in the middle of a nature reserve. The star has read the writer's draft and has, quote, a few ideas. But first he barks at the writer, what are the essential qualities of my character's personality? The profoundly jet-lagged writer, who has not met the star before but has been warned that the star is legendarily difficult, stammers out a short list. When he's done, the star observes, nothing you just said makes me feel any better about playing this part. It turns out that the star doesn't like this sort of movie, action thriller. In fact, he clarifies, I don't like movies. The writer glances at the director. This could be a problem. All three men know that, even now, mammoth sets are being built at Pinewood in anticipation of a shoot to begin 2 months hence. Star, director, and writer sit around a campfire that the star's assistant has built. The writer is trying to stay both warm and sane by gulping large quantities of scotch that the star has graciously offered. It is the only gracious offering that the star will ever make to the writer. Many hours have elapsed. The star is engaged in a marathon monologue, a sometimes surreal stream of consciousness, in which he imagines his character in a variety of situations, existential and suspenseful, none of which have any bearing on the script that is being prepped in England, and all of which violate every principle of movie storytelling that the writer has ever learned. The writer suspects the sun is about to come up. He doesn't wish to be awake and still hearing the star's notes. When this happens, he says he needs sleep. The star, though miffed, agrees that the meeting may continue tomorrow. The writer and director stumble off to their tent some 100 yards away. As soon as they've closed the flaps, the director confides, I know you want to walk off the picture, mate, but if you leave now, you'll be eaten by tigers. Because of this jest, the writer decides to stick it out. Months later, midway through production, the star calls a story meeting one Sunday morning at the London Hotel where director and writer are staying. He is anxious to know why a particular scene he demanded has never appeared in any version of the script. The scene's premise is impossible, nearly insane. The writer earnestly explains, I've tried several times to write the scene, but I just can't make sense of it. Turning deep red, the star shouts, "Just because you can't make sense of it doesn't mean I can't act it." The writer's family wants him to come home. His two young sons are in a grade school talent show the day after tomorrow. Rufo, the writer, explains that a key scene is coming up, on which the star has still not signed off. It's imperative that the writer be on set, ready to make last-minute revisions. On the morning the scene is to be shot, the director summons the writer to his trailer and sheepishly explains that the star and his leading lady have rewritten the scene themselves. They've asked that the writer not be present when they're shooting, lest they feel self-conscious. The writer nods. But the writer's bloodstream seethes with adrenaline. He walks back from the Soho location to his hotel, where he packs his bags, and making a point of not telling anyone on the production, checks out cabs to Heathrow and flies home to Los Angeles. The bad news is he's missed the talent show. The good news is he's free. A year later at the premiere, the writer finds himself standing beside the producer at, where else? The bar. The producer says, "I still don't get why you quit the movie." The writer shrugs, then orders another Cosmo. Some things you can't explain.
With so much being made about digital downloads this past week, we thought it appropriate to offer a little perspective on the current legal fracas between the world's most popular website, MySpace, and the world's largest music company, Universal. Back in mid-November, Universal sued MySpace, alleging the social networking mammoth illegally encourages its users to share music and music videos on the site without permission, which in the common parlance is better known as stealing. Universal is looking for pretty hefty fines, up to $150,000 for each unauthorized music video or song posted on the website. With over 100 million members on MySpace, that's potentially a lot of clams. It seems like Universal still sees the web as a threat to its business. And they might be right, but not for the reasons you think. They know the web's a key place to promote their artists, find new ones, and sell all their music. It's just that MySpace in particular is problematic, in that it's owned by a potential competitor. Seeing the future, News Corp created MySpace Records a year ago. But it's even worse than that. As social networking sites become the primary place for learning about music and consuming it, those companies without their own successful social networking sites are, in a word, screwed. One can imagine a possible future without record labels at all. Consider out-of-nowhere musician Tara Naomi, whose videos have been downloaded over 2.5 million times on YouTube.
I see the lights are turning and I look outside. The stars are burning through this changing time. It could have been anything we want. It's fine, salvation was just a passing thought.
She sold thousands of CDs, even without a major label in her corner. A good thing, probably, because signed to Universal, Tara Naomi wouldn't have gotten a tenth of the attention she's gotten on YouTube and MySpace. If artists go direct to consumers through social networking sites like MySpace, where does that leave the music business? Well, in the hands of the owners of the most popular sites, like News Corporation and Google. They said Rupert Murdoch was crazy when he paid $500 million for MySpace. Now it seems like a steal. With one deal, he may have destroyed the record labels, but monopolized the music business. And that's the business. Matt Holtzman produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Bob Carlson. You can listen to this or any past program online anytime at kcrw.com and click on KCRW A to Z. You can also podcast the show on KCRW's site or through iTunes. Our email address is thebusiness@kcrw.org. The business is produced by KCRW Santa Monica and distributed by National Public Radio. I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner. We'll see you next week on The Business.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the completely redesigned 300-horsepower MDX. More information is available at Acura.com.